Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and it is Friday night, so that can only mean one thing. That's right, a new edition of the Story Blender is just about to come your way, of course, hosted by authors Stephen James and Jose Castillo. On tonight's show, they have very special guest, Dr. Joseph Sobel, storytelling mentor and solo performer. So you're not going to want to miss this one. And you can check out all the stuff by going to thestoryblender.com and, of course, the Fence RadioNetwork.com for more information on this show and all the other shows we have going on the Fence Radio Network. First, though, we have to tell you about some stuff. And one of the things we've been talking about for years is Kensington Books. They bring out some of the very, very best thriller and suspense books, including some new ones which just hit the street. Christine Trent and the Morning Bells. G.A. McKevitt. With The Killer Gourmet and Born of War by Anderson Hart, along with Final Breath by Kevin O'Brien. Make sure you visit KensingtonBooks.com for more information on this and all their titles. I highly suggest that you find out what they got going on. An excellent publisher. Are you ready? Because I want to make sure that you're ready, because thriller master David Morrell has just written the sequel to his award-winning book, Murder as a Fine Art. That's right, everybody. Thomas DuQuincy has returned, an Inspector of the Dead. So see why everyone is talking about these two books? Visit davidmorell.com for more information and get caught back into 1860s London. Mary Burton returns with Be Afraid. This USA Today best-selling author has readers on edge. Fear of the unknown is terrifying, but the truth can be even worse. And this time, a cunning madman will leave no survivors. So pick up Be Afraid on Amazon or wherever books are sold. And finally, Robert Kadira brings the first book in a new series called Red Gold. Best-selling author Vincent Zandri calls it a thriller plot with deceit and danger, but also compassion. Red Gold kept me up all night, he says. So visit Robert Kadira, KIDERA.com. For more information, and buy the book on Amazon or wherever books are sold. But now let's get into it, because here we go. Tonight's edition of the Story Blender, again, hosted by Stephen James and Jose Castillo, none other than very special guest, Joseph Sobel. Sit back, relax, enjoy, because the show begins now.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James.
And I'm Jose Castillo.
And this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling.
And our special guest today is both a performing storyteller, an accomplished musician, and the head of the renowned master's degree program in storytelling at East Tennessee State University. He has a PhD in performance studies, where he studied the modern storytelling revival. And even as he takes the helm of an academic program on storytelling, he continues to perform storytelling in concerts throughout the country. We're so glad to have him today. Joseph Sobel, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jose, and thanks, Steve, for inviting me on.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So I know over the years you have coached and taught hundreds of storytellers through the master's degree program, but also at seminars and workshops. And I was kind of wondering, are there any humorous or interesting or memorable mistakes? You don't have to name names. But stuff that sticks out in your mind, that would be fun to start with.
Yeah, actually, that's a well-phrased question, because it reminds me of something that happened just recently in a class that's still ongoing. We had a first-year student in the storytelling program, a mature student someone with a lot of experience, but hadn't quite slotted into her mind exactly what constitutes a story versus, well, let's say a resume. So she had a personal story presentation to make in an applied storytelling class where you have a persuasive or educational goal with a story, but the aim is to tell a story that puts the listeners in mind of a particular purpose. So she started doing what I've seen many times with storytellers who are just getting into the biz, and that's that she tried to shoehorn her entire life story into a 10-minute presentation. Well, first I did this, I was born here, and I moved there. And in that kind of format, you don't really have time for a story at all. All
right.
You're doing is listing high points or resume points, you know. And I said, do that again, you know, take a week or two, rethink this, and tell a story that actually epitomizes your point and your purpose. Just one incident or one story arc, one set of connecting incidents and lines, consequential actions is what we always say in class. And she came back 2 weeks later, and she had nailed it. She just told one story about a person that she had coached, actually, and the growth in that person from from her first experience ever to a couple years later when she had grown into a woman. But she just did it in terms of two key incidents. That made all the difference. It was moving, it was powerful, it was vivid, and it was it stuck in the mind for the listener.
Yeah, that's good. We were talking with James Rubart, who's a novelist recently.
Mm.
We spoke with him, and he was talking about how gurus or whatever will lay on a bed of, you know, 1,000 nails or something, with concrete, and pile people standing on top of them. And he's like, I would like to see you lay on just one nail.
That one will go right into you, yeah.
Yeah, and he said, that's the secret to great speaking when you're telling stories, is choose one nail. Then look at it from different perspectives, and so people can take one nail away from your message. And I thought, that's pretty good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a brilliant image for it, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think some of the questions that I have based off of, you know, teaching storytelling is that, you know, we're surrounded by it in all the different media forms and things like that, but to take it down to its most purest sense of one person standing up in front of a group of people and sharing a story is sometimes very, very intimidating. So how do we train, teach, coach, encourage people to get to that point where they can share that one story that has influenced them?
Yeah. Well, one interesting thing that's happening in the culture right now is that there's a explosive growth in venues for people to tell their personal stories. It's just astonishing. And I think, you know, the storytelling festival world that I grew up in has been very formal and has a fairly high platform. In other words, you have to climb a great deal. You have to accumulate a great number of credits to climb onto that festival platform. But the contemporary storytelling movement has really branched away from that into a very low platform. So all you have to do is sign up, you know, put your name in a hat, and you have a very short time limit. So, and the time limits are important because it both controls the form of your story, but it also keeps an audience from being bored to death by any one particular storyteller who doesn't have the sense of an ending. Because the ending is called 5 minutes, you know. But with that, it's just created a lot of opportunity, and it's also kind of put a signature on the hunger that's out there, both for tellers, individuals who want to tell, and listeners, people who want to experience life through the words and the presence of another person. And you know, we don't have those opportunities on the bus or on the subway or in our cars. You know, we listen to National Public Radio, and that's a start. But we really do need to be in the presence of each other. to feel the story.
Now, do you think that the insurgence or resurgence maybe of this type of storytelling is there's a response to the, you know, the social networking and so on, where we have 10,000 friends but really have three, you know. So we're more connected than ever, but more lonely than ever. Do you think that that's connected, you know, or is it just the rise in technology or the rise in change in our culture?
Well, a couple things. It's that technological isolation, both connection and isolation at the same time, which is this peculiar and unresolvable paradox that we live with constantly. But it's also, I think, a change in our sense of what a person is. I think in earlier years, when we weren't so technologically soldered together, we were soldered together in small family and tribal groups. And our sense of ourselves in relation to those groups was very collective. And in a collective frame of mind, the stories of the tribe, the heroes of the tribe, the ancestors, the kings, the Finn McCools, the Jacks, the king of the Eastern world, the great collective figures of folklore and mythology are something to identify and something to aspire to and inspire and model each other, model ourselves after. In this culture, it's a very individualistic culture where we think of ourselves as isolated individual units. So, and yet we're collective beings, and we're social beings. And so to hear stories of another individual struggling under those same conditions has the same kind of mythic weight in a way that the old mythology and folklore did. You know, I think of biography as the myth of our time. It's no more true than the story of Odysseus Achilles, but it's true inwardly because it's what we relate to.
Yeah, I like that you know, stories, to me, storytelling always, it always happens in it's a social encounter, and a lot of people sort of forget that. I know when I was a kid, I was in the speech contest in the eighth grade, and so I had this speech that I wrote out about Herman the Worm, and it was all about his soil conservation from a worm's perspective, right?
Oh,
so
I had it written. You know that Jay O'Callaghan's first, one of his first stories was Herman the Worm.
What? He stole it from me.
that's what's called synchronicity simultaneous genesis. Yeah, polygenesis.
Gosh, I wonder what year I was in eighth grade. Well, anyway, I had it written on these, you know, these cards, right? And I practiced in front of a mirror 100 times.
Yeah.
And so then I get up to do it in a speech contest or whatever, and I did it the same as I would in front of a mirror.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, I got third place, and there were two participants, but you know, but I realized as I looked back at that I had not taken into account that it was a social encounter, a social interaction with the judges and the listeners. So it was perfect for a mirror, but that's all it was good for. So,
but you never looked at the faces of your listener and used
because
they're a mirror too, in a funny way.
Yeah,
but you've got to look into it.
Yeah.
You know, I was listening recently to a friend of mine share some stories, and he said that this paradox of technology and being lonely but being connected is based off of the fact that we have traded community for productivity in the sense that we have now said what used to take me one story told to another person or to my family around the table, and then that would be shared with somebody else and maybe on a small stage in front of somebody, et cetera, is now very easy for me to just type it out and click, you know, update on Facebook, and now 1,000 friends can hear my story. But that's not really community or connecting.
Well, it's
but
a
it is
funny
productive.
Thing. Yeah, one of the graduates of our program, very talented woman, she is a Facebook industry, and whenever I flip to her page, and it's this weird combination of sociability and reticence, because you know she's a very shy person. She's one of the shyest storytellers we've had. But when she gets on Facebook, she's an absolute lion, roaring with passion and insights, and she's gathered this little Facebook community around her, the people who obviously are in awe of her posting, her prolific output. Every time she posts, it's like, "You are awesome! You are awesome!" That's a lot of that's a lot of feedback, you know.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is today in our culture, obviously there are tons of different ways to tell stories. Twitter is a storytelling forum, but I don't, don't usually think of it in that way. But in a sense, it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have Instagram and Pinterest and all of these ways of expressing, you know, our emotion and our passion.
And it's a very low platform. The only, I mean, low in the sense that you don't have to climb very high to get onto it. All you have to do is sign your name in electronic form, and there you are. And if you have a good story, like the fellow who was experiencing the end of his marriage recently on Instagram, I think it was, or Reddit.
Did you run across that?
Yeah, and he was tracking his wife through the process of her having an affair, and it was, and posting just prodigiously, you know, in enormous detail, in novelistic detail, about finding the suspicious texts on her phone while she was in the bathroom and the dialogue back and forth. "Oh, nothing, huh? Not to worry. I'm going out with some girlfriends." And this whole thing was unfolding over in real time, over the weekend in which this was happening. And then he would say, "Gotta go. She's coming in. She's coming into the house now. I'll update you later." And the "you" that he was referring to was thousands of people all around the country that he didn't know by name or face or anything. And I was wondering, you know, at the great climax was when he confronted his wife with this, all the evidence of the infidelity, and she broke down and wept and, you know, accused herself and accused him and back and forth, and the marriage was over and they both got lawyers. And then he broke it off because he was getting offers from TV producers to do this as a series, and he thought he ought to stop now because there were copyright issues involved. But it was the funniest thing. And then I was thinking, is it more unfaithful for her to have actual sexual relations with a man in a hotel room over a weekend, or for him to broadcast it to millions of anonymous voyeurs all over the country in real time? Which is more unfaithful?
That's interesting, yeah. And you know, it wouldn't have even been on anyone's radar screen 20 years ago.
Exactly.
I mean,
it's
like,
not something that anyone could have imagined as a storytelling forum. But that's what it is. And the nature of its truthfulness or fictionality, because there was, of course, following on the intense interest in this and the viral propagation and the millions of hits and so forth, and it, you know, got into the papers and it got onto the Huffington Post and everyone's writing about this. Then there come the question of, was this a plant? Was this somebody's creative endeavor? And did they make the whole thing up? And, you know, in a sense, it doesn't matter because it's all story. You know, it's all storytelling. It matters, I'm sure, to him and to his soon-to-be ex-wife, if in fact he exists. But then,
if in fact he exists, is a great
Then you get this whole idea of, you know, who do we really exist? That's what I mean by biography is the myth of our time. I mean, our actual existence in this world is such a fragile, temporary, evanescent kind of phenomenon. If we can make a good story out of it, that really makes us feel like we're here. You know, it's a momentary but tremendous affirmation of our existence.
Yeah, and you know, stories are a way where we try to live in the minds and hearts of other people and try to live on after we're gone. You know, the stories that we've told and we've lived and we've shared, and and that's just really interesting. I know that you tell stories in a variety of ways, both through music and through through writing and performing and telling stories yourself. And a lot of people forget songwriting, just as we've been talking about all these other things.
That's
they're storytellers as well. And you know, how does that form of telling shape this tale that is told? Let's say you're using musical story, musical, or your songwriting. How does that affect as you shape or craft a story that, that might be told?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a great and enormous question, so there's no way I'm going to encompass it in a short interview. But one thing I've been thinking of a lot is storytelling, the rhythmic aspects of storytelling, and the in a way, the mathematical. Songs and music are dancing numbers. They're entirely mathematical in their underlying structure. And we don't experience it that way. And we can listen to a song and never be conscious of the mathematics underneath. But anything that has a rhythm scheme is either in 3 or 4 or 6 or 9 or some combination or compound of numbers. And the verses have to arrange themselves according to those numerical schemes too, in lines of 4 beats or 3 beats or 5 beats with a rest or a caesura in order to accommodate an underlying rhythmic scheme. Let's say you want to set up a verse of iambic pentameter to music and you choose a 4-4 rhythm. You need to break in certain places. So that's all mathematical. But stories too have their mathematical aspects, and they have their planned repetitions. They're crafted repetitions. The law of three is the most common example of that in fairy tales. You see it all the time where an incident repeats 3 times, the first 2 times as cautionary or failed attempts, and the 3rd time as a success or an accomplishment, which mirrors the structure of the mind in terms of the way we learn by repetition. But it also is musical. So I think being aware of music and the underlying musical forms inside a story in terms of stanzas and chapters or episodes or groups of stanzas that have a certain kind of rhythmic structure
that's good. You know, I was when you were talking about that a minute ago, I was thinking of a couple weeks ago, my wife and I went to see some comedians, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there is a definite beat and rhythm to the way
comedians. And it's unconscious, but it's unconscious in the way music is. I mean, comedians talk about it all the time. They talk about pairs, you know, jokes that come in kind of dyads or call responses, but they're always triads too.
Yeah.
Little sequences of 3 beats.
Callback
and the third one, without the third one it wouldn't be funny.
Yeah.
But it's the trinity of it that makes it funny. I mean, you named your daughter that, so you know all about that.
Exactly. Yeah. The other side of the, you know, songwriting and music and some of that in storytelling is how the listener or the viewer participates with that. And I think we're seeing, particularly in our remix culture, and where now we have the opportunity to take one thing and turn it into something else, or take one thing and riff on it and make it into our own. You talked about those low platforms for people to be able to engage with.
Right.
How is music and songwriting changed and given new platforms for, you know, pretty much anybody, even some without musical ability, to tell stories?
Well, you know, it's been like that for a while. I think pop music and the whole folk music revival of the 60s, they had many aspects, and some of them had to do with a certain kind of classicism, that is, an appreciation for tradition and lineage. But there was also, at the same time, a kind of as Robin Williamson put it, chops-free performance, you know, people who didn't have to know an instrument to pick one up and play it. That was what punk was about. I read something recently about the Go-Go's, four girls from Santa Monica who decided they wanted to be in a band. Why? Because they wanted to be in a band. It was cool. And none of them had any instrumental ability or skill, so they just, it didn't matter. Since nobody knew anything, just assign the instruments at random. You play bass, I'll play guitar, you play keyboards, and I'll be the singer. And they, inside of 6 months, they were selling a million albums. Because, again, that same kind of identification on the part of the popular audience with people who are really just like them, only a little bit bigger, you know, a little bit glossier, a little bit shinier. So you get that with YouTube all the time. Remember that some of those YouTube dance videos, you know, somebody sitting, yeah, some nerd sitting in his room and kind of freaking out to music. Who was that guy who said, leave, he had a big thing on a female.
Oh, yeah, leave Britney alone.
Leave Britney alone. Yeah, and he melted down on camera, and instantly he was famous.
Yeah. You know, he was from Elizabethan, Tennessee, right down the road.
Yeah, wow. our county.
Yeah, and wound up going out to Hollywood and starting his own blog and everything. I mean, it was amazing from that one performance on YouTube.
Exactly. That says a whole heck of a lot about the shape of our culture, you know, the cultural forms and the cultural hungers that are there. Both on the part of the guy making that video and the millions of people in their little bedroom nooks, you know, sitting in front of the computer and soaking that up,
watching it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now you mentioned earlier.
It's a kind of personal story.
Yeah. It's really, to me, it's fascinating that I look and I'm like, why did this get a million views? And part of it's curiosity because everyone's like, whoa, have you seen that?
Yeah.
But a lot of times it's somehow doing that, where it's telling some sort of story that reaches people where they are, and then the beat of our culture and connecting with, you know, where people are at. And, you know, nobody really knows, I don't think, what is going to, you know, go crazy. Or else,
uh-huh,
I know publishers would only publish 10 books a year, and they'd each sell, you know, 50 million copies, and
right. They
don't really know. So you take a stab at it, and you try to tell stories that reach people where they are. And
yeah.
You know, you mentioned earlier some of these emerging forms of story. Now, I've heard
uh-huh
about story slams and the moth. Are these
uh-huh
some of the new emerging
forms?
That's
what I'm talking about. The moth was sort of the prototype for this new open mic personal storytelling. And they had a very interesting combination that they put together, because it was put together by a writer, a guy, a novelist, George Dawes Green, who said that he used to go to a lot of poetry readings, and he'd noticed that the moment the poems start, the whole audience would nod off. But when the poem was over and the poet would start telling a story about the next poem. Well, this happened when I was breaking up with my wife of 27 years, and my daughter was beginning to get into hard drugs, and we had to put our divorce on hold to go rescue her from a crack house. It just got really interesting, and everybody woke up.
Wait a minute, how did you know my story? Oh, wait, no, never.
So he said, maybe I'll have a poetry reading that just does the stories, the intros to the poems, and leaves the poems out altogether.
Yeah, that's right.
And everyone would be really interested. And in fact, it just took off. You know, they had the first of those kinds of events in his living room, and then they got so popular, they had to rent a room, and they went to bars, and they went to auditoriums. Then they went on the radio. They an organization accreted itself around this phenomenon. And that's the most interesting thing. That's really what happened with Naps in the first place. Nobody had any idea that storytelling, well, when I say Naps, probably many of your listeners may not know that I'm talking about the founding of the National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro. And nobody had any idea that this would be a popular phenomenon. But inside of a couple of years, the ambitions of the promoters, you know, got stimulated, and they formed an organization. But the organization wouldn't have had any legs if it hadn't been for the magnetic interest that people all around the country started to experience for this little town, this little cultural phenomenon that it spawned. So storytelling keeps on doing that. And I think when the festival became a kind of a standard form, it settled into its own kind of cultural niche and the audience started to grow older. And it became, instead of a radical thing, it started to become, in a sense, a conservative thing. It always had the seeds of that inside it because it was about conserving tradition, and that always has its retro romance. But with this new storytelling thing, George Dawes Green started bringing together actors and journalists and novelists and poets and media figures and celebrities of various kinds. And they were on the same platform as cops and forklift drivers and any kind of ordinary citizen. And it was the interesting equalization that fomented that made it really magnetic. And it had some of the allure of celebrity culture, but also it had the allure of reverse celebrity culture, sort of un-celebrity culture.
Do you know how people can get connected with that? Let's say there's some listeners who say, I'm really interested in whatever Joseph's talking about.
If anyone can figure it out there, yeah. But we run a story slam in Johnson City during the semesters, and usually once during the summer during our classes. And we've been having them lately at Nelson's Fine Art in Johnson City. But the Moth has events in, started in New York and spread to Los Angeles and San Francisco and
really
Chicago and Detroit, Ann Arbor. One of our current students runs the Moth events in Detroit and Ann Arbor. There's one in Atlanta. Louisville, I believe, has one. So but it's also spun off other kinds of story slam events. And in New York, apparently, it's just everywhere. There are literally hundreds of story slam events every month. And the slam aspect, what that has to, that comes from the poetry slam world, which is something that's pretty established. It's oral poetry, people reciting poetry, often very hip-hop influenced. But it has a competitive element, and the story slams have actual teams, and people get their judges and their points and their winners and their losers, and, you know, Americans love that kind of the possibility.
Does anybody get voted off the story slam? That's what I want to know.
There you go.
Well, not in ours, no, but there are people who are, you know, get their feelings hurt when they don't win.
Yeah.
But, you know, to me, what that does, in a sense, is it brings the competitive aspect out of the closet. With the festival world, and you know the one I grew up in, the idea of competition was utterly anathema. People would really sneer at the idea of a storytelling contest. Oh, that's for people who really don't understand the wonder and beauty and the all-embracing community of storytelling. But then you had those festivals where there were maybe 15 or 20 tellers on stage and 3,000 in the audience, and somebody was losing.
Yeah.
You know, hundreds of those people in the audience were people who had applied to be tellers at the festival and hadn't gotten in. So, you know, there is competition. It's just nobody's actually acknowledging it publicly. Whereas at the slam, it's part of the ceremony. You know, it's there, and people can get absorbed in that aspect of it, or they can just kind of shrug it off. And I think that's what most people do, is they participate in order to participate, and if they happen to win, well, that's just great. And if they don't, well, that's just great, too.
Now, I know you mentioned the kind of the storytelling festival culture, and I think you did your PhD doctoral thesis
mm-hmm.
on that. And studying that, and just from my experience being a part of some festivals and telling at some
yeah.
festivals and so on, it seems like a lot of storytellers don't like the word performance. And your PhD is in performance studies.
Yeah.
I don't even know if you remember, but I spoke with you on the phone long before you ever and went to ETSU, and I had somehow tracked you down, and I just said, tell me about this performance studies thing, and you talk to me a little bit about it, because I was thinking, do I want to go and get another degree or anything like that? Thankfully, you talked me out of it.
Oh, well, I'm not sure if I want to
You just kind of scared me. I was like, man, that sounds like a lot of work. I think I'd rather go write a novel. So.
There you go. Well, you did just fine. I think you made a good choice. PhDs are... That's a whole vexed topic, probably for another time, because it has to do with the structure of academe and proliferation of adjunct teaching, and it's really kind of a horrible thing. But performance studies just acknowledges the fact that we're always performing in life. Formally, informally, we're presenting ourselves, and there are performative aspects to almost every aspect of social existence. And some of those performances are formal and acknowledged as performance, what Richard Schechner calls the restoration of behavior that's been behaved that way. It's been done once, and you figure, that was so good, I'll do it again.
Nice.
And that's performance, you know, the shaping of experience into form. But, as performance, Catherine Windham said to me once that she didn't care for what was going on at Jonesboro anymore because it's not storytelling, she said. It's performance.
Yeah.
And she said it with that great weight of Southern genteel disapproval. But, the moment you get up on stage and do something that you've done before, it's performance.
Yeah, I think so too. And it's kind of refreshing to hear your take on that. I know I went through the master's degree program before you were there, and it always struck me as strange that it was in the education department, there was nothing wrong with that, but that there weren't any cross kind of, I don't know, cultural, not cross-cultural, but anyway, any classes like in theater or speech.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is storytelling. We should be working with the theater department and the speech department and the English department, because we're creating and shaping and crafting stories, and it should be sort of this place where all of these departments come. And some of them didn't even hardly know about it. I was like, I went to the speech department one time and said,
when did that happen?
Storytelling
program? Well, it's a long, slow battle for legitimacy within the academic framework, because storytelling is unfortunately burdened with some associations. Like the most common one is, oh, you're a storyteller. What books do you like to read to your kindergartners?
Yeah.
But that's not exactly how it's done. It's like folklore, which is a great academic discipline with a long history. But when you use the word folklore at the wrong table, what people hear is quaint. And so folklore within the academy has had a burden with legitimacy. And a few years ago, there was a big kerfuffle about maybe we should change the name of folklore to cultural studies or something that has more dignity.
Yeah, that would have really helped.
And fortunately, the old line folklorists who loved the discipline for what it not only for what it was, but for what it is still as a tool for understanding human behavior and culture and creativity, said, folklore is a great thing. It has an immense intellectual pedigree. So I think storytelling is just beginning to attract that, and it comes from the recognition that stories and telling stories is such a fundamental aspect of what we do. It's active in politics, it's active in law, it's active in business and organizations, it's active in all the things that Americans are very proud of and passionate about, like selling stuff. you got to pay it heed, because the story, people are just recognizing that the story is fundamental to everything about shaping desire. Desire in action.
Desire in action, when we've talked to different authors, storytellers, novelists, and so on, we keep revolving around this idea of a character who has an unmet desire, and then he pursues it or she pursues it, and that journey through the story, and when it's emotional, when we can connect with it, it draws us in. Absolutely. I don't think it matters so much if you're writing it or tell. I mean, there are obviously different tools that you'll use to write or tell it, but it all revolves around that emotional connection with the character who's seeking something. So based on your background, I mean, you've taught some of the most renowned oral storytellers in the world. Distill it down to maybe two or three keys to delivering a story that really connects, building on this idea of emotion and drawing them in. Are there any things that pop to the top of your list?
Well, if it moves you, it'll move your audience.
Nice. Yeah.
At the same time, you have to have a sense of form and a respect for the form. That means not making it about you, but your heart and the openness of your heart is a barometer, is a great tool. There was one of my favorite stories is the story of White Bear, and I got this particular version from Donald Davis way back when he was still a Methodist minister in High Point, and he told me about the version that he heard growing up. It has all these wonderful images, including the at the end when the girl who's been chasing this man who used to be a bear across mountains and valleys, and she's been at it for seven years and then another 7 years, and carrying a sack full of golden nuts to use when she's in the worst trouble she's ever in. And at the end, she's sitting at the edge of his bed, and she's got her hands on his feet, and she's saying all night long, over and over again, "Three drops of blood I shed for thee. A beautiful babe I've born for thee. White Bear, turn to me." And something about that chant just distills, and again, we were talking about rhythm and music, with all that, it distills the feeling of desire in action, an unmet desire. And finally, he opens his eyes, not because she did it, but because just the sentence has been lifted. And it never fails to move me, but it takes about a half an hour to get there, you know. So you have to, at the same time, you have to build the story to that point, and then you have to just let the emotion flow. I don't get a chance to tell it that much because it's a half hour story, and you know, it takes a lot of concentration and a lot of listening.
Yeah.
But I told it to a group of 7th and 8th graders the other day over in Bristol. And, you know, mostly 7th and 8th grade girls. And every 7th and 8th grade girls is waiting for a bear to come and take them away. So, you know, it just had that rightness and that moment when our hearts flowed together in that chant. And that's what it's all for, you know, just you can wait lifetimes to get to that point where you can express that.
I remember when you were sharing that. I remember I was working as a wilderness guide back in the day for teen delinquents, and we would go on these 30-day long trips. And I remember we called it "Hoods in the Woods," but not to their faces. But early in one of the courses, I was new to this, and I didn't know. I was kind of intimidated and scared. Some of these kids could have been gone to juvenile prison. We're sitting around a campfire, and I said, "All right, do you guys know the story about the hook or whichever urban legend it was that I told them?" And they're like, "What? What's that?" And I told them the story, and I told them another one, told them another urban legend, and then I got done, and this guy said, "Oh, did you ever hear the one about?" And then he told a story, and someone else told a ghost story, and suddenly we were not juvenile delinquents and wilderness guides. We were just a bunch of people around a campfire telling stories. And I remember all those boundaries were just gone and erased the stories brought us together, just like they did with you as you told that story to the students recently.
Yeah. That's what's important is being open to that experience, to that that liminal place where all of the roles and costumes and masks that we wear just slip away, and we're all in this common state of wonder.
Man, this has been incredible. Really enjoyed hearing your your perspectives and points. You know, the master's degree program in storytelling is pretty unique at ETSU. If somebody's interested in finding out more about that, how can they find that information? Where should they go online?
Well, it's just easy to Google ETSU storytelling, and it should pop up etsu.edu/stories. It's a fairly simple URL. And my email's in there and my phone number, so, you know, get in touch.
And is there another place that they can track you and maybe where you're going to be performing next, or just Google
your
name?
I have a website, www.josephsobel.com. Of course, I had to subscribe to that cultural format. these days, I'm working on I had a show of W.B. Yeats' poetry that I set to music a few years back, and this is Yeats' 150th birthday this year. It's being celebrated in Ireland and all around the world, so I'm kind of reviving that show, but it's a cumbersome show with six people, so I'm doing it as a concert by a late, great singer-songwriter. So it's a solo show, and I'll be doing that a few places leading up to the anniversary, the June 13th birthday party.
Very cool. Well, Joseph, thanks for your time, and thanks to everyone for listening. Remember, folks, to spread the word and share the link. You can check out my latest stories and books at stephenjames.net.
Of course, you can find out more about my spicy projects at thinkjose.com.
And for more about our guests and to check out our other broadcasts, click to thestoryblender.com. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.
All right, are we...